So this is an awesome honor. I'm very grateful to the National Science Foundation for the work that you do, and for funding this field and for inviting me here this morning. In particular, I'm especially appreciative of the time, guidance, and consideration that Keith Marzullo, Gerald Mumpower, who you just met, Nina Armla, Jeremy Epstein, and Chris Clifton have provided, and also the patience that David Evans exhibited in communicating with me for this event. I have sort of reached an Archimedean point in my life that I want to share with you. It crosses computer science with social science, and I've been working on a book along these lines. So my plan for this talk is to read some passages from the book and to show you some slides. This is an awkward presentation for me. It's the first time I've done this. But I think it's important because it has exactly the same duality and format that represents the blend that I want to talk about in content. Basically, I'm looking for a few good souls to help save the world. And so I'll start by talking a little bit about me and how I got to this point, and then I'll share with you what I see. At the age of 6, I asked my great-grandmother, what do you call a person who loves math? A mather, a mathete, a mathman, or a magician? My great-grandmother opened the big dictionary whose faded, tattered pages had resided on the family bookcase for so many decades that its shape was permanently engraved there. She announced the word is mathematician. A 6-year-old girl who wanted to be a mathematician was an oddity my great-grandparents never understood but always supported. While my peers voiced ever-changing ambitions of becoming firemen, athletes, teachers, and physicians, numbers spun in my head. 1 + 1 is always 2, no matter how big a number, I can add 1 to get a bigger number still. A multitude of mathematical truths created a magical world of certainty and intrigue. And in comparison, my everyday life was complex and confusing. I was the only child I knew whose great-grandparents was raising her. They had reared 12 children of their own and had a half score of grandchildren. It was only my lineage that had a divorce, a consequence that left them raising me. It's all complicated and messy, but in my world of numbers, 1 + 1 is always 2. My fascination with math continued through geometric proofs and algebraic equations. My search for never-ending mathematical absolutes zipped me through all available math courses at my middle school, so I embarked on college courses. And then in a flash, my messy life got messier still. A stroke took my great-grandmother, my great-grandfather followed thereafter. I was alone and isolated, and my faith and love of math was all I had to sustain me. But on the upside, it is math. I had established a noteworthy academic career for a young kid, and others noticed, and before I knew it, I had a full-ride scholarship to an elite all-girls boarding school in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Dana Hall was a fantastic mater, nurturing dreams and coddling fantasies to create mythical worlds without limit. I soared there. It was safe and beautiful, and the sidewalk seemed to have been scrubbed clean each day to give it extra sparkle. My love of math soared. When I exhausted their math courses, they helped me enroll in math courses at nearby Wellesley College. Yep, I always wanted to be a mathematician until I didn't. It wasn't a single point in time or even a specific day that that change occurred. It took a few weeks. I started spending all my spare time, even weekends, in a closet. I think they call it love when your eyes get wide, your heart races, and no matter the conversation, it's all you can talk about. That described me whenever I thought about that closet, the place where the school's computer sat. It really wasn't a computer, but a terminal that I used to phone a computer at Dartmouth College. I enrolled in the computer class at Dana because it was the only math course I hadn't taken. I could never have predicted its profound and lasting impact on my life. The certainty I enjoyed with math took physical form in programming. My numbers and equations were replaced with logical sequencing. My writings on papers became programs that others used to accomplish real-world tasks. I was doing all kinds of stuff on the computer. No class, activity, or sport in which I participated escaped my writing some kind of program that did something for it. Teachers, students, and administrators were using my programs for automated quiz reviews, sports simulations, word conjugations, automated art, and so on. It seemed as though I could do anything I wanted on a computer. What is a person who loves computers called? I asked. My teacher answered, a computer scientist. From that point forward, being a computer scientist is all I wanted to be. And as the decades rolled by, I became just that, a computer scientist and a professor to train other computer scientists. The integration of creativity, mathematical certainty, and real-world applicability that drove me passionately to computers in that course at Dana Hall has powered my life ever since. I proceeded to invent technologies and launch my own computer businesses. Eventually, I returned to school. One day in 1997, while I was a doctorate student at MIT, an ethicist, Dr. Beverly Woodward, visited our computer science lab. As I walked past, I heard her say, "Computers are evil." What? My beloved computer's evil? Surely I could solve her problem or fix her thinking. So I stopped and inquired. She explained how in Massachusetts, the Group Insurance Commission is responsible for purchasing health insurance for state employees, retirees, and their families. In order to better understand costs, she said, GIC had received copies of computerized medical records containing diagnosis and procedure information, along with the patient's date of birth, gender, and five-digit zip code from the hospital visits of judges, policemen, and other state officials. She voiced potential ethical and economic harms to them as individuals and the ability of others to use the information to subvert judicial law enforcement and regulatory systems. Once captured, ongoing sharing of electronic data without the patient's knowledge was too easy, she argued. And as if to prove her point, GIC had already given a copy of the data without patient names to researchers and sold a copy to industry. She foretold this as the beginning of a new era in which people's data would be shared widely without their knowledge. She ended her monologue with me, and she said, "And so, computers are evil." I reminded her that these are the same computers and data that may save lives within those hospitals. She asserted that the data are not inside a hospital anymore and asked me, "Is it anonymous?" I did a quick mathematical calculation in my head. There are 365 days in a year, two genders, and people live about 100 years. Multiplying these out gives 73,000 unique combinations, but the average five-digit zip code has only about 25,000 people. Uh-oh. Is there a quick experiment, I thought, that could test this out? William Weld was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, and he had recently been hospitalized. Little was known about his condition, but his information was in the GIC data. Governor Weld's date of birth and home address in Cambridge were publicly known. And so for $20, I purchased the Cambridge voter list at City Hall. It included the name, address, date of birth, and voting details of 54,000 registered voters. This figure shows how matching on the demographic fields, date of birth, gender, and zip code, can be used to put names to the data from the voter list. The question is, how unique would this be? This diagram shows an excerpt of the voter list, sorted by date of birth and then by zip code in a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet. And as you can see, six people had Governor Wells' exact birth date. Only three of them were men, and he was the only one in his five-digit zip code. His demographics, birth date, gender, and zip, were unique in the voter list and unique in the medical data. Governor Wells' name unambiguously matched to his anonymized medical record. I started out trying to fix Dr. Woodward's thinking, but in the end, her challenge enlightened me. News of the Weld experiment traveled from Cambridge, Massachusetts to Washington, D.C. and around the world and inspired further analysis that impacted federal regulations. A long-standing cornerstone of privacy jurisprudence is that you cannot be identified, you cannot be harmed, so your data can be shared widely for many purposes. In the 1990s, the common practice was to merely remove a person's name to render the data anonymous. It was simple and easy, but in the wake of the Weld experiment that showed how easily disparate data sets can link together, the practice no longer worked. If names can be put to anonymous data, people can be harmed. Computers changed everything. Not everyone understood it. What did this have to do with computer science? Computers were changing everything, but should computer science research include ways computers can reshape society? Perhaps not, was one answer I surmised after over 20 failed attempts to publish this and other works in computer science venues. However, 30 years earlier, in 1967, three pioneers of computer science, Alan Newell, Alan Perlis, and Herb Simon, wrote an article in Science entitled, What is Computer Science? They defined computer science as the study of the phenomena surrounding computers. Their essay asserts, one, that computer science is the construction of complex instruments, an engineering pursuit. Computer science is the study of algorithms, a mathematical pursuit. And computer science is understanding the natural phenomena surrounding the existence of the machine in its environment, a social science pursuit. Since that writing, computer science matured, and its evolution has heavily relied on engineering and algorithmic methods. The social science fusion got lost. I knew of no computer science classes then that considered the issues, better yet, that attempted to address the problems raised. As computers were becoming ubiquitous, studying the environment in which they operate was becoming paramount. Computer scientists, more than anyone else, were well positioned to do this work. Computer scientists should be highly motivated to do this work in order to ensure the viability of new technological innovations. Still, computer scientists were not doing it. What is this work? It's architecting a technological society. Outside of computer science, social scientists were beginning to look at technology issues like the digital divide and the social interactions of people using the internet. These studies use social science methods, surveys, naturalistic observation, data analysis, and experimentation, but they treated the technology like a rigid black box, thereby ignoring possible engineering and algorithmic remedies and not in addressing more intricate conflicts. Yep, I started out trying to fix Dr. Woodward's thinking, but now I had to help fix the integration of computers into society. What experiments could I do to help illuminate issues? What new technologies could I create to help solve society's technologically driven problems? How do I help harmonize technology with society? Everyone should enjoy the benefits of new technologies without giving up long-standing social norms. Before the Weld experiment, I had not thought about downstream consequences and secondary impacts of computers, but I would spend the rest of my academic career doing so. 16 years after the Weld experiment, with sort of mixed gray hair, I entered a building whose doorway read Federal Trade Commission. All I knew about the FTC was that sometimes it would publish a report or a decision that impacted how businesses treated consumers, even businesses on the internet. How did the FTC become the consumer's police force? Why do their reports impact practices on the almost anarchical internet? I had no idea when I entered the building. The doors opened to reveal a lobby with walls of solid marble, dimly lit by ceiling-mounted fixtures outlined in silver metallic trim. They don't build spaces like that anymore. Tucked in a square hollow was a vintage wooden telephone booth. When was the last time you saw a telephone booth? The doors and lights still worked, but it no longer had a phone. Instead, baby strollers from the first floor daycare center crowded its opening. This former high-tech marvel was now an ill-suited storage closet. The lobby was somber and quiet like a museum's. Its artifacts and secrets lie behind a wall of security scanners and guards. I spent the whole day barely venturing from the lobby, giving biometrics, signing documents, doing online compliance training, and creating lots of long and very complex passwords. My first day as FTC's new chief technology officer ended with me learning nothing more about the FTC than when I entered. Nothing that day, the people, the place, the phone booth, or the marble walls, gave a hint that I had entered Spider-Man's den. Spider-Man is the champion of the little guy, and he's my favorite comic book superhero. When a radioactive spider bit regular human Peter Parker, he gained superhuman strength, rapid reflexes, and the ability to cling tenaciously to most surfaces. He improved his powers through his own hard work, effort, and training, eventually becoming strong enough to throw a car, collapse a wall with a punch, lift 10 tons, and do gymnastic flips over entire buildings. Spider-Man only uses his powers to fight evil, and he does so for no other reason than doing the right thing. The local press scorns him despite his amazing feats of good. When facing a notorious foe, he doesn't just start using his superpowers. Instead, he first uses his brain and thinks of a plan. What really cinched him for me was a connection Spider-Man had to my great-grandparents. His code of honor, with great power comes great responsibility, was the same as the biblical one my great-grandmother had instilled in me years earlier. For those to whom much is given, much is expected. The FTC has its own unique combination of strength, speed, and agility. Its mission is to protect consumers and promote competition. President Wilson signed the Federal Trade Commission Act into law in 1914. The act empowers the FTC to protect consumers by stopping unfair, deceptive, or fraudulent practices in the marketplace. The FTC conducts investigations that result in monetary redress and other relief for injured consumers. It develops policies and practices for businesses, and it educates consumers and businesses about their rights and responsibilities. The act also empowers the FTC to promote competition by stopping anti-competitive practices such as monopolies, monopolistic mergers, price fixing, bid rigging, fraudulent or deceptive advertising, and unfounded product claims. The FTC monitors business practices, reviews potential mergers, and prevents or dismantles any that could harm consumers by resulting in higher prices, lower quality, fewer choices, or reduced rate of innovation. The act establishes the FTC as a bipartisan independent agency. It has five commissioners, and by mandate, at least two of the commissioners must be from the opposing political party. The position of chief technologist, also called the chief technology officer, began in 2010 as a revolving position for a maximum two-year term for computer scientists. Chairman John Leibowitz appointed Ed Felton as the first, Steve Bellavin was the second, and Chairwoman Edith Ramirez appointed me as the third. Because the CTO position is within the office of the chair, the scope of activities across the entire FTC operation. Because the position is so new, there are few established demands. So I was free to dive into investigations, policy issues, internal technology concerns, public workshops, congressional responses, and other encounters and issues important to the FTC and chairwoman as my skills, interests, and needs warranted. And frankly, I did them all. From the CTO position, the organization is flat and malleable. In fact, it appeared so flat, I could never remember who was in what bureau or who was the boss of whom. I know I had an organization chart somewhere that described the bureaus and further breakdowns, but for my job as CTO, everyone was accessible. When an issue emerged, teams would promptly form across organizational designations, and those teams made decisions subject to minimal hierarchical review. As a result, the work environment was highly productive, fun, and exciting. It's no wonder that the FTC was voted one of the best places to work in the federal government. Frankly, I found it the most collegial environment in which I'd ever been. It was an amazing job. Only the commissioners and special appointments like me have term limits. The rest of the people tend to be lifers. Almost everyone I met had been there for decades and intended to be there indefinitely. The people of the FTC are busy in all kinds of issues all the time, working tirelessly on behalf of the American consumer. I saw FTCers combating issues with massive corporations and at other government agencies, often being the only lone voice to help consumers. I saw FTCers go head to head even when the offending party was another government agency. They did not stop at American borders either. They assumed leadership roles and pioneer partnerships with sister agencies internationally. FTCers are busy tackling matters on all fronts all the time, so much so it boggled my mind as to how they do so much with so few people. If only the American public knew what was going on, the FTC would be championed as America's superhero. Instead, the external appearance of the FTC is very different. The same smiling, friendly folks who work passionately and tirelessly would turn stone-faced in public or in meetings with outsiders. Only insiders get to see the inside. Outside, the demeanor of those same people often appears detached, evasive, and ironically uninterested. An impenetrable wall of secrecy divides inside from out, presumably so that the commissioners alone are the external face and voice of the FTC. The many works and solutions FTCers pioneer that never rise to the commissioner level go unknown to the public. When the FTC does make an announcement at the commissioner level, it is often misunderstood and discounted, having gone through a bipartisan political process. Not everything is beautiful. Most FTCers are lawyers, and that says a lot right there. There is a contingency of economists. The most important reason for having the CTO position at the FTC is to bring in fresh perspectives about technology and technology policy into the private world of the FTC and to educate FTCers about new and ever-changing challenges and possible remedies. But just as computer scientists and social scientists have their own disciplinary tools, lawyers also have a unique disciplinary perspective. Guided by legal rules and arguments narrowly specific to the side they represent, lawyers, just like social scientists, tend to treat technology like a rigid black box and thereby ignore possible engineering and algorithmic remedies, are unable to address more intricate nuances, and sometimes are unable to even separate inherent technology features from a specific presentation of the technology within a business practice or product. The ways in which one technology product works does not mean all products that use the technology must work the same. For a century, the FTC has warped itself to meet the ever-changing nature of businesses, products, and services. But as the telephone booth in the lobby warns, the FTC risks becoming outdated and relegated to a lesser role. A glaring issue is the lack of technologists. The CTO position is a great start, but the omniscience of technology throughout business practice requires technical knowledge throughout FTC's organization. The unique task undertaken by the FTC requires its own technical tools, too. After all, the FTC originated in an era where the offending party had a direct relationship with the consumer. In this earlier time, an FTCer could visit a business engaged in potential wrongdoing and witness the behavior firsthand or view the internal books and documents of a company to expose harm to consumers. Increasingly, technology-powered business practices are hidden and distributed. A good example, just as the GIC example foretold, are chains of sharing personal data today without the person's knowledge. As data sharing chains get longer, the potential for personal harms increase, but the ability for the FTC to detect or assess those harms decreases. The FTC needs better technical tools to follow those chains and to ferret out wrongdoings. So computers have changed everything, and the FTC will have to change in substantive ways to meet those challenges, else risk becoming increasingly less effective. Is there a brighter tomorrow in which the FTC could play a prominent role? Will the Federal Trade Commission become the Federal Technology Commission? Will there be a bureau of technologists at the FTC? If so, who will train them and what will we teach them? What is true of the FTC is also true of computer science. Computers have changed everything. Will computer science help engineer a technologically powered society that harmonizes technology and society? Personally, being at the FTC was exciting and fun. I saw an overarching model for the first time that harmonized personal conflict and societal damage with business interests. The FTC began because of growing concerns over how some business monopolies might wrongly take advantage of consumers. American society needed an empowered group to review and prohibit business practices that would limit or eliminate competition to the detriment of consumers, investors, and the economy in general. When laying the cornerstone, President Roosevelt recalled the adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Today, there are growing concerns over how technologies, or more precisely, technology companies and technology-powered businesses may wrongfully take advantage of consumers and thwart societal protections. Is the answer a new empowered group? Should we retool an existing entity? Can we incentivize technology developers and technology-powered businesses to add an ounce of prevention? Yep, by being at the FTC, my work ascended. For the first time, I could see the topology of technology society clashes. By the time I had arrived at the FTC, I had invented technology, pursued technology business ventures, became a technology educator, researcher, and scholar, worked with privacy advocacy groups, exposed technology society clashes, and busted myths about privacy protection. I have 3 patents and have authored about 100 academic publications. 2 federal regulations explicitly cite my work. Still, it was not until I became the chief technologist at the FTC that I transcended those angular perspectives to see the whole. I could see what worked, what did not, and more importantly, where opportunities for improvements exist. So I've arrived at this point. What do I see? Let me first tell you what I see looking backwards in time. After all, why does enjoying a camcorder, a new computer, or a football game mean we have to risk personal harms like loss of privacy? In 1983, Sony introduced its camcorder, a mobile device for consumers to record video with sound. In the United States, you can usually video a person in public without his knowledge or consent. But if you want to record his conversation, electronic wiretapping laws dictate whether you must get his permission, and the requirements vary among the states. The camcorder from Sony had no mute button, making it impossible for consumers to capture video without sound. Replicating the design today, almost every mobile phone and digital camera still records video with sound and provides no mute option. Consequently, people routinely shoot video that may violate wiretap laws, and in some states, people have faced felony charges as a result. For a fraction of a penny, a camcorder with a mute button would have harmonized camcorders with existing laws. In today's devices, a software option instead of a physical change would do the trick. However, broad adoption of these devices with no mute option seems to be changing American social and legal norms. In a 2007 case, a political activist reportedly violated a wiretapping statute by recording video of a Boston University police sergeant during a political protest. Today, legal challenges are moving in favor of individuals recording law enforcement officers in public. A news article describes a case of a parent wiring his special needs child and capturing insults hurled at the child by a bus driver and teacher. Last year, Pennsylvania passed a new law that allowed video cameras to be mounted on school buses to record video and sound. Did the technical design of mobile sound recording devices change societal norms? In January 1999, Intel wanted to enhance the security of online communications by embedding an unalterable unique number in the processor of personal computers. Their idea was that when a computer engaged in communication over the internet, the communication would include the processor's unique identifier, thereby associating the computer's actions to its physical processor. Sales and usage records could further relate the processor to an owner and location. Within 2 months of the announcement, privacy and consumer groups filed complaints with the FTC. Their complaints argued that a unique number could also allow unknown observers to track computer use across the internet, even if the user was not being malicious or doing anything wrong. Supplemental complaints explained that surreptitiously tracking the movements of individuals on the internet violated expectations of anonymity and the fairness and control over personal information. By April 2000, Intel acquiesced and abandoned its original technological approach due to privacy concerns, and their stock prices fell. Today, mobile phones have unique numbers, these media access control or MAC addresses, used for network communication beyond the phone number. Retailers and others are experimenting with using these unique identifiers to track the whereabouts of mobile phones in physical space, in stores, malls, and even on the street. Is this a case of social norms shifting about tracking, or of society not yet aware of the aspect of wireless mobile communication? In January 2001, police in Tampa, Florida tested facial recognition technology during Super Bowl 35, scanning faces of people in crowds, comparing them with images in a database of digital mugshots. A few months later, a council member in Jacksonville, Florida introduced legislation banning the use of face recognition software by the sheriff's office and other city agencies. Other city councils and legislators considered similar legislation, but the events of September 11, 2001 dramatically reversed the projected end for facial recognition technology. A decade later, facial recognition technologies have flourished. Contacts range from online social networks and mobile apps to digital signs. According to a 2012 FTC report, uses of facial recognition now include determining an individual's age range and gender in order to deliver targeted advertising, assessing viewers' emotions to see if they're engaged in a video game or a movie, or matching faces and identifying anonymous individuals in images. Is facial recognition now harmonized with society, or might planned uses risk further disruption and abandonment? In these historical cases, technology designs and uses clash with societal rules and concerns and user acceptance. Outcomes included revised laws, technology disruptions, inconsistency, and an uncertain future. These cases underscore the power of technology design. Our students are the new policymakers. They weren't elected, they weren't trained, but they are, in fact, the new policymakers. We should think about training them to reason about policy and social impact in the creations they design. This is essential to harmonizing technology and society. Computers have changed everything, and computers are changing everything, and computers will change life as we know it in almost every conceivable way. Privacy and computer security were just the first wave of incompatibilities. We see how well that has gone. The country experienced some of the largest breaches of personal information while I was at the FTC. This is a situation where the old policies allow the status quo and the incentives are not present to escort in technological fixes. My students, and probably your own, have published thesis after thesis that offer innovative, practical solutions to this problem. But those small businesses and inconvenienced consumers lack the power for change. Consider also other disciplines. Over the next 5 to 10 years, every aspect of social science research, from data acquisition through interpretation and impact, will be altered by technology. Traditional, famous, and well-known theories will be redefined. Even something as basic as studying conflicts between countries is changing. For years, scholars in international relations have collected dyadic data on war. Country A does X to country B in year Y, where X is mostly a military interventions by countries that result in at least 1,000 battle deaths. Recently, with the president announcing a proportional response to the cyber attack on Sony, an attack that was attributed to North Korea, the study of international relations has now become the study of cyber attacks. Do any of the old theories hold? How do you even study them? Over the next 5 to 10 years, all of society will be reinvented through technology. Almost every law will be redefined by what technology enables or does not. Here is a glimpse from the kinds of research I worked on while at the FTC. With Uber, Amazon, and other related technology businesses hiring so many people as independent contractors, how will the Social Security safety net work if these workers are not contributing to it? How should this impact labor policy? Should algorithms be held responsible for disparate impact? Societies have identified groups of people to protect from specific forms of discrimination. In the United States, these include some decisions and offers based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. The laws include the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Equal Opportunity Credit Act, the American Disabilities Act, the Fair Housing Act, and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. To make determinations whether a protected group experiences legal discrimination or is being treated unfairly, government entities often measure whether practices, intentional or not, have a disproportionate adverse impact on the protected group. FTC hosted a workshop about fraud on the internet a couple of months ago. Often we talk about there being one internet. I was able to show that there are actually many different internets and the experiences differ among the groups in the communities. And this has a dramatic impact on fraud and disparate impact. For example, I was able to show how online ad auctions can cause a disparate impact on protected classes using credit card ads and how legal cases could be made. Will legal actions appear against algorithms or companies based on decisions made by their algorithms? Who is to blame? Technology is increasingly moving us to a new uncharted world. As an example of the limits of law and impact of technology, consider the Data Map Project from my own work. We were interested in documenting all the flows that data might go after it leaves the doctor-patient relationship. We weren't the first to do this. This is sort of a documentation of those flows from a National Research Council report in 1997. This is what it looks like today. If you were to click on one of those nodes, it gives you some public documentation as to who the companies are that are doing the sharing and the evidence of that link. But what I wanted you to see today is how many of those flows are not covered by federal regulation, the federal regulation known as HIPAA. So how do we move forward? The insight is to help decision makers to reason about optimal fusion of technology governance and business across stakeholder interests. Today, different situations empower stakeholders unevenly. Which stakeholder prevails depends on the political persuasion of the empowered stakeholder among the polarized perspectives of the others. No one group, technologists, policymakers, or advocates, is sufficiently motivated or positioned to do the kind of unbiased, big-picture thinking needed. As a result, society currently gets contests that yield poor results. Maybe we need a new discipline or a new area. If so, let me just at least coin it as technology science right now. It needs to answer an overarching question, and in the case of technology science, that question is, how do we engineer a society that enjoys the benefits of new technologies without societal harms? Perspectives of law, policy, and business are already represented in technology society clashes. We need computer science to architect solutions. We additionally need scientific methods, naturalistic observations, surveys, interviews, case studies, and experimentation, the kinds of methods popularized in the social sciences. It is only through a fusion between computer science and social science that we can save the world, and I hope you will join me. What do you call a computer scientist who wants to harmonize technology and society? A harmonizer, a technologist, an integrator, or a blender? My answer is an architect of tomorrow. You have a wonderful conference ahead. The other keynote speakers I know very well, Dan Geer and Deidre Mulligan, will be great, and they'll offer even more insights about tomorrow. Thank you. Yes.
Okay, good. So thank you for the talk. So there's a perception, and I think it's a fairly true one, that technology and business move really fast, and government and especially legislating move really slow. Right. And I would love to hear your perspectives from being at the FTC. Is that an insurmountable problem that technology has advanced to the point where they've had this major impact on privacy and society before we've had a chance as a society to figure out whether we need to legislate about those technologies?
So first of all, anything I say doesn't represent the FTC. It just represents me. But that will always be the case, that law, because of the way laws get created, that there will be this temporal mismatch between law and the rate of technology innovation. And then sometimes the law is a nice guide. It gives us nice rails on which to keep the norms. And other times, in fact, maybe even most times, it's just a weird, odd fit. It doesn't quite work. And so right now, that answer turns out to be whatever the random decision is made by the designer at the time they make the technology. And what happens later is it kind of gets pushed on into the technology as it becomes a product and a business case. And so what the regulators are left with is this sort of package deal with a lot of entrenched interest. The key to changing it is not to necessarily figure out how to make laws move at the speed of technology, nor is it to slow down technical innovation to the crawling pace of lawmaking. The solution is for those who are designing technology to understand better the choices that they're making, so that arbitrary decisions that we have to live with long term are actually thought through. And it's also important to have a group of people who are constantly keeping that vigil, scientists who are looking at how is this technology going to work out? What's the right way to harmonize it? Is it a change of the law? Is it a change of business practice? Does that make sense?
Hi. I've been attending a fair number of talks about privacy in the last couple of months. And I've heard a number of perspectives on the definition of privacy. The PCLOB had a workshop a few weeks ago about this. And there seems to be one side of the spectrum that says privacy is really control. It's about control over your data. And there's seems to be a growing swell, I would say, on the other side saying, well, it's really about responsible use of the data because we really have, in some sense, lost control with the means of surveillance that's already deployed really all over the place. And I'm just interested in your perspective on those definitions and where you see the future going with respect to third-party responsibilities over data based on your experience with the FTC in the past year.
Right. So again, my views do not reflect the FTC. They're only my views. So the first part of what you said, the issue of what is a definition of privacy, I just want to say that privacy, as far as I can tell, has so many definitions that it's really, usually when I get called into a privacy debate, the first thing I do is ask, where's the money? Because the money interests determine what the privacy debate really is about. And I have many great examples of even where the same pharmaceutical company uses privacy as a sword to say that's not a problem, let's use it to slice and dice and get access to data. And the same pharmaceutical company in another case that I was involved in used privacy as a shield. You can't possibly have this data because of privacy concerns. And so when I hear this question around privacy, is it around control or is it around use, I ask myself the same question, where are the money interests? And the money and political interests are in use. The government has made tremendous use of personal information. The government has a vested interest in making personal information readily available. So do many corporations. The only ones who have a different interest are the individuals themselves. And so the conversation about use and control is really a conversation around government and business versus the individual. It's a lopsided conversation that right now, as far as I can tell, there's nobody advocating really that has any teeth for the individual side. But that's how I would look at that discussion, and if I wanted to intervene in that discussion, I would intervene through those lenses.
So I, if I can just respond for a second, I guess one of the difficulties that seems to exist here is the difficulty in being able to characterize the benefits from use of the data versus the harms in some rigorous way. Did you see any opportunity for that? Well, do you see any opportunity for that?
So whenever I do re-identification experiments and things like that that show the potential for harm, they have a very chilling effect on the conversation because they show the potential for real harm. One of the things that happens when you look at that data map and you see where all the data are going, there's just no way you as an individual would know all of those places. And so, for example, there are loops in there where your employer can have information about you. And Linode did a study where Fortune 500 companies admitted to making hiring, firing, and promotion decisions based on medical data. That's absolutely illegal. But if you're one of those patients, one of those employees, there's no way you could prove it. And so a conversation around harms as part of the conversation around use or control is also kind of a difficult conversation to have because we actually have lost the ability to track harms. You don't know who has your data. When a creditor, you know, there have been lots of anecdotal examples of creditors who've made creditworthiness over data they weren't supposed to use or have. But you have no way of knowing what data they actually used and whether or not they even violated a law. So therefore, you could be harmed. The public may very well be being harmed. We have no way of knowing that. So harm is a really, it's a good example when you have a smoking gun. It's a very difficult criteria to use in general in today's society, unless we just simply add far more transparency to data sharing.
So let me then ask if you see opportunities from the technological side to help us be able to track the way the data is used.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are many possible technological ideas. I mean, I could go on ad nauseum, but just to kind of give you one example, you could imagine, suppose we all had the right to say, if you have my data, I should be able to ask you and you could tell me who you gave that, whether or not you have it and who you gave a copy of my explicitly identified data to. That would mean that we could actually write technology that could do one of these data maps for every individual person. So you would actually know who has your data. If a breach happened, you would know whether or not your data was likely to have been in that data. You would know whether or not who else they have given the data to and be able to say whether or not an employer or a creditor actually used data about you that they should not have had. And in fact, that alone would have a chilling effect on ill use. So that's a way in which technology could kind of balance out the use argument.
First, I should comment, since we're talking about privacy here, that this is being recorded, and so if you don't want to be recorded, you shouldn't ask questions.
I'm good.
Well, I meant that.
Oh, for the rest of everybody else.
Someone else, yes. I know you signed something saying that you're okay with being recorded, but for the rest of us who are asking questions. So the great Carl Landwehr, who preceded me at this microphone as well as in my job, is teaching a course called something like Security for Future Presidents. What do we need to teach today's undergraduates? And I think it's undergraduates, isn't it, Carl? Yeah. So that 20, 30, 40 years from now, when they're a CEO of a corporation or the president of the United States, they'll understand security, not computer scientists, but whatever, business majors, people who will end up being lawyers, whatever. What do we need to teach today's undergraduates so that 20, 30, 40 years from now, they'll understand the privacy issues that are going to be of that day, which are presumably not going to be the same ones as today, or will we be struggling with the same things then as we are today?
So, you know, there's a laundry list of things that I could say, what should they be taught? But I think instead of addressing the laundry list, let me answer through a kind of anecdotal example. Let me talk about the kind of things we teach in the courses at Harvard, the reaction to that course, and what happens to those students. We teach a course, its name keeps changing. Sometimes it's Data Science to Save the World, other times it's Privacy Technology. But basically, in the course, we limit the number of students to 20 to 36, depending on which form of the course it's in. And we normally get around 100 or 150 students apply for this class. So we make those students have to go through all of this stuff to get in this class. They have to write an essay. They have to do a YouTube video about why they should be in the class. And we go through this vetting process to pick the 20 or 36 that will be in the class. Most of the about half the students are social scientists, maybe a little bit more than half, actually, are computer scientists. These students then go off to work. Where do they go? They go to Facebook, they go to Google, they go to all of these, most of them go to these top technology companies, just like their counterparts. But the difference is they're on a different track. They get paid more, they're put in leadership roles, they are kind of in a weird fast track because they took this one class. What is it that this one class is giving them that gave them that advantage over their computer science peer? We teach them one thing. How do you spot issues? How do you do risk assessment? How do you know what's likely to go wrong in this design? And therefore, it's going to change the world or pivot or run a high risk of a problem for your company or your organization. And I think if there was one thing to say that should be in that portfolio, it's really that. that, you know, that's not all that has to be there. How do you deal with that risk is another part of it. But that's what we've been doing to address it, and we've had tremendous success about where our students have gone on based on one course.
All right, so thanks for the talk. I found it really inspiring. I had basically the same question as Jeremy, so I'm going to shift it a bit. So with the course you just described, you limited it to, say, 20 or 30 students. Do you think that learning about the intersection of technology and society, should this be something that only a few students do, or should this be something that we try to do more broadly?
So first of all, I would never describe the class as technology and society. The class is very much about, you're going to be making some decisions. How do you decide? Here's a new technology that just came on the horizon. Where are the problems going to be? Let's predict them. Let's figure out where they are. Let's know how, and we try to tool them up with that. It's not a passive study of technology and society. It's an active issue spotting kind of approach. We would like very much if all computer scientists had it, because after all, it's computer scientists primarily who are making these technology design decisions. The reason we limit the course, though, is because it ensures us the right level of communication with each student, the ability for each student to articulate what they think the issue might be, the ability for students to debate on the current events. Half of our curriculum, we don't even know at the time school starts. It's whatever evolves on the front page of the news is what we normally pick up, for example. So it's very timely, it's right on the cusp of everything, and it forces us to have to go into different disciplines based on whatever the issue might be. And that's, I think, very indicative of where they'll go after they leave academia. I don't know what job they'll be in, I don't know what technology they'll be faced with, but I just want to be able for them to think about how do they spot issues, how do they reason about it, how do they take a biased position, because in the end, their company most likely needs a biased position. Does that help?
Hey, LaTanya, great talk.
Hi.
Very inspiring.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. So, you know, I followed Jeremy, and then we all these questions about education, but so my question is maybe a bit broader than just a course for how you might train future leaders of tomorrow, but we have, you know, 400 researchers here. How do we train researchers of tomorrow to do this technology science? I mean, you came from a computer science background and sort of discovered the value of social sciences. That's kind of the way I came about it too. Do you see that we need to continue with sort of choosing a disciplinary focus, like a computer scientist who sort of sees the social science aspect that they can maybe learn after the fact or learn in graduate school while they're doing research, and then complementary a social scientist who sort of interfaces with technology later on, and sort of do you see that as the model going forward, or do you see a sort of more fundamental change that's needed of trying to actually integrate down, you know, a technology science curriculum that blends things from the beginning on up? And how do you see it changing if we want to actually make the difference that you're sort of charging us to make?
So, I mean, that's a great question. You know, what really the issue here is about how do you architect a system across technology and society? So you have a new technology, how do I actually architect a system? That is definitely not the scope of computer science. And computer science has a success record that nobody wants to really mess with, right? So I don't know that the answer is to change computer science to make everyone an architect. You know, as much as it is, how do we train architects? They need some computer science knowledge. And what I mean by architect is, I don't mean just architecting the technology. Sometimes it's the law that's got to change. Sometimes it's threading the needle of how the business will operate that gets past the law but is doing the right thing in the long run, but still being able to make the business case. That's a space that there is no computer science publication that would publish that paper on any topic. But yet, you know, so this is a great example. The students in the class write papers at the very end. I would say more than half of the papers that the students wrote the year before I went to the FTC became content that people at the FTC used while I was there. So it was very timely. It was right on the mark. It's exactly what not only the FTC, but the companies that the FTC governs are looking for the same thing, the Googles and the Facebook. They're looking for people who can answer that too. And I don't think it's about changing computer science. I think it's about a new discipline or a new area of computer science. But it's something we don't do right now. That I think, and there's lots of low-hanging fruit. But the other part of your question was, how does it relate, though, to what you do do? What you do right now is research. Not only just research, but it's the leading edge, cutting edge, bleeding edge of the research. And it's that exposure that the students need. Those same students that want to be architects need to know what is tomorrow bringing, the car that's going to drive itself, if we were to go back 10 years and look at the DARPA challenge. And what would that mean? And how do you make that come about? And what are the issues? It's the exposure to your work that those students still need, even though they're not your typical graduate student.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes, I wanted to get back to that privacy technology course that you mentioned. You indicated that that was perhaps the distinguishing course in the success of a lot of the students. My curiosity is why you would only offer one section and not have that kind of a required class for every student. You mentioned that there was a high level of interaction, but you can say that about a number of different types of courses, particularly given the resources that you have at Harvard. So my question is, why do you only have one section? Why don't you have it taught to everybody, since it's so beneficial to career patterns and such?
Well, I think part of that answer is, first of all, the course is offered in three different venues. So like all schools, Harvard has disciplinary silos. This is a class that really isn't fitting into a disciplinary silo. So the reason for the changing name and the changing numbers and the changing focus has to do, is it being taught through the government department or is it being taught through computer science, for example? And so it's not that it's just one course in a year and that's all you get. But resource allocation and requirements is not a function of me making an argument. It's a function of a department or multiple departments making arguments. You know, the computer science educational agenda in every school is packed, right? I came from Carnegie Mellon. I went to MIT. I mean, everyone is still pushing a lot of content in there. Now, if you want me to go and try to make this case that it should be a part of the educational core of computer science, that's one thing. Or maybe it's just that people will self-select and go into another area to do this kind of study, and then we could make it richer. So we're trying to figure, we're believing that the latter is more desirable than the former. But ultimately, that depends on your schools and the politics and circumstances of those schools. But probably, you know, what are we really talking about is a research program and undergraduates, not a new graduate program. It's undergraduates exposed to the latest technology with this idea of issue spotting and risk assessment. It's the lowest hanging fruit. I sort of answered your question. I didn't, because I don't run Harvard. Nobody made me a dean. But if they do, right.
Okay, thank you.
I have two questions. The first one is, you had said that when you give demos, they tend to have a chilling effect on the observers. And I completely understand that. But what I don't understand is why that chilling effect doesn't have some impact in terms of changing the law, or is it just the issue of following the money? The second question is, if you have pretty scary consequences of exposure of certain kinds of information, and those consequences are made public, would there not be some kind of a public uprising Or is it the case that there are just certain personality types who on the one side are true believers and on the other side are true doubters?
Well, to the first part of your question, many of the reidentification experiments that I've done have exactly done that. They've changed the law. So the most recent one would be Washington State, where for $50 I was able to purchase a copy of hospital data from every hospitalization in 2011 in the state of Washington that was provided by the state's public health department. It's called hospital discharge data. There's one in your state too. But and so I took the data and matched it against newspaper articles, just simple matching, not statistical, just exact matching, to put back names to those records. So now you would know that a particular person had a motorcycle accident, and now you could look and see how he paid for it. You know, you could learn about any sexually transmitted diseases he had or drug abuse and so forth. And so we re-identified all of them, as many as we could, in a sample using this direct matching. We gave the names and the content to Bloomberg News, a reporter at Bloomberg News, who contacted each and every one of those people to verify that we were correct. They agreed that they would only publish the medical content of people who agreed to it, because there were businessmen, there were professional athletes, there was a congressman, and things like that. And so they did, and they published it. And the state health department in Washington State went ballistic, because that's what happens when you do these things. And she expressed to me, you know, the dilemma that she felt she was in, that she has this Freedom of Information Act request where she has to provide information. On the other hand, there's this privacy problem, and she just didn't feel politically she was in a position that they could do any further redacting of the data. But after the news articles ran, they passed a different law in Washington State allowing her to clearly be able to redact this data sufficiently. So, and there are many other examples of that I have where these reidentifications, not just Weld, but lots of them, have actually changed policy, changed regulation, or changed law. I think your question, though, is how do you do that more generally? How do you do that more generally? Not every exposure creates that change. And how do you make an exposure create the change? Notice that I said I gave the results to a Bloomberg News article, news reporter who wrote an article about it. This is not incidental, right? So actually plotting to have impact is part of what you have to do. You say, this is an experiment that I'm doing, but part of this experiment is not just about the science of the risk of reidentification in that case. It's also very much about how do we force a change in this space. And so part of what you do is think about how you do that. That's a part of that architecting thing that I keep talking about.
On the second question about the public uprising?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, so I was a graduate student at MIT when the HIPAA debates happened. And if it wasn't for the timing of that Weld experiment just gave me this front row seat to the debates that became part of the discussion of HIPAA privacy rule. And what was so amazing to me was it was on the backs of five people. So Congress had this thing called the Kennedy-Cassebaum Bill, which was trying to basically reduce healthcare expenses. Healthcare was out of control, the expenses were out of control, how do we reduce the cost? And their idea was to simplify billing, because at that time, every insurance company had their own forms, their own codes, and if you were a physician and you signed up with one insurance company, it was so much administrative overhead, you were pretty locked into that one insurance company. So the idea of the Kennedy-Cassebaum Bill was to level the playing field by making all the forms uniform. And it had this one little part in it where it said, and furthermore, we'll clarify who the patients are by making a master patient index based on everyone in the country's social security number. And it was on that phrasing that five privacy advocates created an uproar the uproar that became known as the HIPAA privacy rule. In fact, we don't even think of HIPAA as being about all of the simplification stuff that the law really is about. We only think about it usually as the privacy and security rule that happened because of these five individuals. And so even TIA, the Total Information Awareness, also had this, just a couple of people pivoting the whole conversation. I'm not an advocate, and so I don't do privacy advocacy. So when we think of those five people, that's what advocates do. So I don't know that I can generalize your question beyond saying that when I do experiments, I try to make sure my experiments touch to the points that will have impact, and that I also understand clearly the role of advocacy groups. I think we're on that side.
It seems like the FTC has a really great set of privacy and security problems that need to be solved, but it also feels like, from my outside perspective, that if we as researchers ever address any of them, it's almost accidental rather than intentional. So, for example, when I was doing research on smartphone privacy, after it was published, I got a lot of communications, media publicity, and then was contacted by FTC folks, and I found out, oh, that's really cool, it actually helps them. And this seems really suboptimal because, again, there's this great set of problems. We have a whole bunch of researchers, and they're not really coming together.
Right.
And so I would just have two suggestions, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on them. One would be, are there better ways of having the FTC and researchers communicate with each other what their problems are and what the possible solutions are? And the second one is, are there any possible funding models for this as well, too? So, for example, maybe through NSF, maybe through other kinds of approaches, or maybe having the FTC even fund 6.1, 6.2, or 6.3 research?
So I am so on your page. So one of the things that the chairwoman would, here's LaTanya's vision. I would like to see the FTC have a Bureau of Technologists, the same way they have a Bureau of Economists. And a Bureau of Tech, and the many at the FTC are definitely in favor of this. There are some caveats. The first caveat is, and who would these people be? Right? So they said, look, suppose we did set up a bureau and we wanted to hire 50 people today. Who would that 50 be? How do we get them? So what we did do was during the summer, we started a fellowship program. And the idea of these fellowship programs was to bring in students, to bring in faculty members who could do revolving doorway on sabbaticals and things like that, in order to build relationships with the FTC. I did have conversations with NSF during my time at FTC around this very issue as well. So this is part of what I'm asking you to join me in. And yes, nonprofit granting groups are also interested in this problem. So I think over the next year, we will see, hopefully with your help, we would like to see opportunities exactly like that. So a workshop where people could come together, show their work and so forth to the FTC is actually something that's been slated in two venues. One is late spring and funded by the Ford Foundation, and one earlier in March. So that would be something. We're trying to open those channels, if that helps. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just, you know, you do research and the FTC may get it on the other side of the wall and they're like really ecstatic, and they desperately need a lot of the research that many people would like to do, but there's no conversation there to shape it or fund it.
Great, thanks.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention something on the flip side from what I'm hearing. I'm an economist, and I've had a lot of students looking at discharge data and trying to, and they need the zip code data because they want to know the demographics of the population they're considering. Everything here, I mean, it's chilling to think, oh, someone could identify me.
Right.
But I also worked at the FCC, and I know that you can make a law that can make sure there's absolutely never a deviation from the ideal, but I'm not hearing is, what risks are we taking in terms of the inability to analyze important issues,
right,
such as medical treatment, such as safety issues, if we take a sense of zero tolerance for any lack of privacy. There's a cost as well as a benefit. And I'm mainly hearing about the cost, I guess because we really don't have a law of privacy right now, so it makes sense. But I think that needs to be part of the equation.
Well, first of all, I really applaud your comment because, you know, the temperature of the conversation was exactly what you described, and that's only half of the story. So usually, you know, like I said, I'm not an advocate, and usually what I try to go for is a balancing, not a balancing of a trade-off, but what I call the sweet spot, where you get the technology, you get the utility of the data without the privacy concern for some stated privacy concern. So in Washington State, what I had advised them to do was to have one data set that was far more innocuous, that answered basic questions, and then have graduated other data that have more details, but for which you had to jump higher barriers because, in fact, it did create more risk for individuals. And that is exactly what they did.
Right. Thank you very much. I love your term architect for the sense of uniting these perspectives. And in that spirit and the spirit of thinking of the systems of privacy and harms mm-hmm. and benefits, I've been thinking and I wonder about how we can improve the feedback between disclosure of information and privacy harm so that systems can adapt to help us as individuals control privacy disclosures rather than waiting for the loop through the Federal Trade Commission enforcing some laws that some regulators have had and legislators have had to spend years debating. Are there ways that we can tune our systems better to individual regulation?
Well, I love the way you phrased it because in some ways, you know, I've been a critic of the Office of Civil Rights at HHS. That's the group that's responsible for enforcing HIPAA violations. So for many years, they received thousands of complaints and virtually no complaints, no violations were issued. That situation has definitely changed in recent years, but that was their climate, that was their performance earlier. And the reason I single them out in this way is because I think that's a great example of your point that we can't, isn't there a better way? I mean, I've got technology, I've got opportunities here. And so it turns out that there's a lot of power for individuals. And being able to put technological and policy constructs to empower individuals is a very powerful way. So I do have a laundry list of them. But the one I'll just come back only in the interest of time to the example I gave earlier, and that was suppose there was just simply this law that said you have to answer a person's question, you have to keep an audit trail of everyone's data. Then that's an example of a technological opportunity for a person to actually be able to say, where's my data gone, do a risk assessment of their own, and so forth. There are other ways, too. And maybe this isn't the best forum to do it, but did it help?
Yes, thanks very much.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Rachel Greenstadt, Drexel University. I wanted to mention in terms of the impact on the FTC, something that I did, but rather my student did. Michael Brennan, who was a student of mine, a former PhD student of mine, worked at the FTC part-time during his PhD. And I think that that's one way to really mm-hmm. have impact is to send your students there. But he worked part-time, he finished. But the other thing is that while he was there, he wrote, when he finished, he wrote an article, I think it was in IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. There's also a version on Hot Pets on how to how to have impact, like write a short memo and send it to these people. And these are the ways to let people at FTC know about your research and other agencies like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you saw that or thought that is good advice. Or
I did not see that. That is excellent advice. The FTC is... you know, it really is like throwing something over a wall. You have zero knowledge as to where it's going to land, if they're on the other side going, yes, this is the best thing I ever seen, or whether they it just landed in the trash can. You just, unfortunately, you don't know. So I think to the point that was made earlier, can we provide a better mechanism where there's more communication? And it's not just FTC, it's lots of organizations. I mean, I picked on HHS earlier, but they're one of the organizations too. And it's not just the government, it's also companies too, who want to be a part of that conversation. And so I think your point is, there are short-term things I can do, like writing memos and sending things over the wall, throwing things over the wall. But we'd like to build a better structured way. Because by building a better structured way, we'll improve the research, and we'll also improve the research dollars spent, so that more research that wants to be on target to what they want will be on target to what they want.
Hi, I'm Dawn Schrader at Cornell University. I really appreciate a lot of what you're talking about in terms of the interdisciplinarity, in terms of really addressing these issues from, you know, the people who are going to be the architects for tomorrow. But one of the things that I see as an academician and working on an interdisciplinary program with Steve Wicker in engineering, I'm in a communication department, I'm trained as a moral psychologist. So, you know, we're really pulling together this interdisciplinarity, right? And we can do it very easily in terms of teaching. Okay, so we're able to cross-list courses, we get students from all of our disciplines. But I think the biggest frustration that I see is, how is it that we can have the impact that we're talking about? So, you know, where is it that we can actually be publishing and having people read in a very interdisciplinary kind of way? How is it that we can begin to change the structures of academe so that we're not so heavily siloed? So, you know, these are things that we run into. So we're submitting papers in engineering, but we'll never get the, you know, psychologists to start reading it. Or we're sending something to a communication journal, and they say, oh, well, this would really fit better in an engineering. So, you know, we're in this frustrating part of it where, yeah, as an academician, we need to, I don't know, how can we create a different way of disseminating information to make a stronger impact? And then secondly, how is it that we can take the results of the research that we're doing and actually bring it to people like the FTC or, yeah, you know, Future of Privacy Forum or something like that?
Well, this is exactly why many of us believe that it really is a new discipline. It needs its own journals, because it's related to computer science, but it's not really computer science. It's not normally what we think of as computer science. And so that's why many of us believe it has to be its own discipline. And one way to grow that discipline, obviously, is to have journals. And the other way to grow that is to have funding in SF. You know, but probably just taking the research and bringing undergraduates into that world, you know, is what we're thinking of. Because the truth of the matter is, you can do that with undergraduates because the fruit is hanging so low,
right,
that an undergraduate can write a paper and voila, the next thing you know, they're testifying before Congress, mm-hmm, which is what the experiences we've had.
Okay, and how is it that we as researchers can actually put ourselves in the position to be heard? I mean, to put ourselves in the position to be heard with the results of those findings, you know, not just kind of waiting for the next generation to come up through Google,
yeah,
but how can we, you know, make that impact?
That's why I think the visibility of a discipline is the right thing, because the visibility of a discipline will bring the regulators to a group, mm-hmm, who's trying to solve their problem. There are regulators in this environment right now who have a particular interest in cyberspace and cyberspace funding and cybersecurity. It would be nice to have that same thing, but around a slightly different conversation.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry for the shameless self-promotion, but I couldn't help myself. So I am editor-in-chief of a new journal of cybersecurity that's published by Oxford University Press. It's open access, and it's designed to be interdisciplinary from the core. In addition to computer science, we're taking submissions from psychology, economics, anthropology, and so forth. So if anyone is working in these interdisciplinary areas, they're having trouble getting published in disciplinary journals, come see me. My name is Tyler Moore from Southern Methodist University. I'd be happy to talk with you. Thanks. I don't, actually.
Thank you.
So I want to thank Dr. Sweeney again for a very inspiring and enlightening talk.